Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Jimmy Akin here this hour for Open Forum, and two lines are open, so that's a good opportunity for you, because usually the lines just fill right up when Jimmy is here. 888-318-7884 is the number. Open Forum, as you may know, means it's open to anyone, and when Jimmy's here, you can ask about anything, anything. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, Senior Apologist at Catholic Answers, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Guten Tag, Jimmy Akin.
Guten Tag, Herr Kellett. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. I practiced my German so I could greet you in German today.
Good, good. Or gut, gut.
Gut.
Yeah, so this is my third hour answering questions today.
Oh, really? Why?
Well, because they had me into the local RCIA group this morning to talk to them, and I answered questions for 2 hours straight with no commercial breaks and no Cy Kellett taking up time, so I talked pretty solid for 2 hours.
Taking up time sounds a little dismissive, but
the questions were almost all of them. For the first hour and a half, they were all pre-written, so I actually had to read the questions too. I didn't even get a break to let someone else ask the question.
Well, next time I'll come host. If you want me to do the hosting at the RCIA, I'll be happy to do it. I need the gig.
To pay for the plane fare to bring you in.
Right.
That's fine with me. I always enjoy working with you.
How big a group was it?
As I've often said, I have a high tolerance for psychedelics.
Which is something I do appreciate. And it's much needed sometimes when we do those weeks where we do a lot of pre-records and stuff. But was it a big group?
It wasn't a particularly big group. They have two different RCIA sessions during the week, one at night and one during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've kind of got a divided group. So neither group is huge, but all told, they have... They do have quite a big gang overall, but the Friday morning group tends to be smaller because most people are working Friday morning.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great. That's pretty good. Get Jimmy Akin to come in, do 2 hours of, I'm sure there's a lot of RCI people who are thinking, I didn't get that. 888-318-7884 is the number. Jimmy Akin is our guest. If you're in RCIA, you can call, and because you fall into the category of everyone, and everyone is welcome to call. I want to go to Newfoundland, Jimmy. I want to get to Colin's question. I'm anxious to hear the answer.
Well, right. I understand there are regularly scheduled flights there.
No, I'm just going to push the button.
Okay.
Colin
button next.
Is in Newfoundland, Canada, where the Vikings first landed, I think, listening on Catholic.com. Hello, Colin.
Hi,
Colin. Okay. You're on the air. What's your question?
Okay, thank you. I've heard it said before that the Ethiopian eunuch that Philip meets and baptizes in Acts chapter 8 mm-hmm. is the founder of the Ethiopian church, but how would he found the church there if he's not ordained a bishop, or he's baptized but he doesn't seem to receive any sort of holy orders?
Yeah, so this can be understood in more than one way, and I haven't checked to see what the Ethiopian churches have to say about it. They may well claim him as a founder, even though he was not a bishop, so far as we know from the New Testament. And I think it's pretty safe that he wasn't a bishop, at least initially, not when Philip baptized him, because Philip couldn't even confirm people. This is Philip the Evangelist, not Philip the Apostle. They're two different Philips. And we know he couldn't confirm people because he didn't confirm the Samaritans, who he also evangelized in Acts chapter 8. And so he baptized the Samaritans, but then they had to call to Jerusalem to get Peter and John to come down and confirm them. And so Philip wouldn't have been able to ordain the Ethiopian eunuch. But that doesn't stop him from being a founder in the sense of the first person to preach the gospel in Ethiopia, because he was from Ethiopia and he went back to Ethiopia and he just had his life revolutionized by embracing the message of the Messiah. He'd already been, a worshiper of the Jewish God, and so people would have known about that. And now he's got this exciting news that the Son of God has come in human form, and he has died for our sins on the cross, and he's going to want to tell people about that. And so he would start the church in Africa, or in Ethiopia at least, in the sense of being the first evangelist, the same way Philip was an evangelist.
Okay, Colin?
Okay.
Philip
yeah,
also... Yeah, Philip also, we could note, and again, in the same chapter, he started the church in Samaria, even though he was just an evangelist. And the same thing could have been true of the Ethiopian eunuch.
Colin, thank you for getting us started this hour. Going to Texas now. John's in Texas watching on YouTube. John, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Mr. Aiken. My question today is kind of a follow-up from yesterday about angelic hiddenness.
Okay.
How would you respond to a skeptic who says, why don't angels preach the gospel to save people in Africa or to the whole world?
Well, sometimes angels do preach the gospel. I mean, that happened, for example, in Luke chapter 2, where on the night Jesus was born, you got these shepherds out watching their flocks, and an angel shows up, later backed up by a whole bunch of other angels. Initially, it's just one, but an angel shows up and tells them, hey, the Messiah's been born. Why don't you go take a look? And then they do. And so you do have angelic preaching of the gospel to humans in a situation where there was no human messenger who came to them and told them this. So it is something that can happen and from a Christian perspective has happened. In terms of why doesn't it happen more, well, that's something we could speculate about. But I would say a couple of things. The first is that even though God can and has occasionally sent angels to preach the gospel, he's apparently decided to allow humans to be the primary ones who spread the gospel. He doesn't normally send angels. He normally allows humans to do this work. Now, you might wonder, and this is going to lead to the second thing I'd have to say, you might wonder, is that unfair? Is it going to, you know, cause people to be damned? Because some people don't have humans who've reached them with the gospel. And the answer is no, because this is the second thing. God only holds people accountable for what they know. And so if someone did not know the gospel through no fault of their own, then God's not going to hold them accountable for knowing the gospel. And if they otherwise lived up to whatever degree of light and grace that they had, then they will be taken to heaven on the basis of what Christ did. They'll just have to wait till they get to heaven to find out it was Christ that did it for them. So in terms of why it doesn't happen more, one, God has apparently chosen to let humans normally do this for other humans. And two, God takes into account what everybody knows and doesn't know. So if someone doesn't know through no fault of their own, because an angel didn't come to them, God is going to not hold them accountable for that, and they can still go to heaven.
Okay, John?
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. Thank you, Mr. Aiken.
No problem.
All right. Thank you, John. I think we can get another call, and before we have to go to a break, let's go to Pennsylvania. Andrew's in Pennsylvania, also watching on YouTube. Andrew, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hi, Jimmy. I was just wondering, what do you do or how do you approach somebody who kind of comes to Christianity with this perspective of, you know, in a world where everything that seems too good to be true is, and this almost can seem to be another case of that, where God loves you so much and he gave his son to die for us. And because of that, we all, you know, you can merit eternal life and blah, 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 blah. And it just sounds so incredibly good that I find sometimes myself, even as I'm explaining it to somebody who may be an atheist or just agnostic, I step back and, you know, for a week or so afterwards, I'm like, what the heck? Like, I totally understand how they feel like this because it just sounds so bizarre that it sounds like there's no way. And I'm just not really sure how to deal with that myself or how to approach people that feel like that.
Okay. Well, I think that there are a few relevant things to say here. The first one is emotional reactions are subjective, and they can vary not only from person to person, they can vary from time to time. So something that is especially new, or if you're presenting it to someone for whom it's new, it can sound, you know, amazing and bizarre and unexpected. But when you get used to the idea, it doesn't sound so amazing and bizarre and unexpected anymore once you live with it for a while. So people have different emotional reactions, and emotional reactions are not objectively valid. They're shifting and changing, and they change over time. So we shouldn't put too much weight in our emotional reaction to an idea. The second thing that needs to be said is that there's just a lot of things in the world that sound surprising and bizarre when you first learn about them. Our God, the Creator, he's a God of surprises. And the more we've learned about the world, the more amazing it has been. And it's particularly amazing for people when a significant discovery is made. For example, let's take Isaac Newton. Cy Kellett.
Yes.
What is Isaac Newton famous for discovering? And don't say calculus, because...
Oh, no. Leibniz. And it's not apples either. I think it's gravity.
Gravity, yes, indeed. So when Isaac Newton first proposed gravity, people were just stunned by this concept. I mean, part of the reason it was stunning is he was proposing that the same force that causes apples to fall here on Earth also moves the planets. And that was the first grand unification in science, that things we could see happening down here on Earth were governed by a law that also pertains up in heaven. And so it was stunning for that reason, but it was also stunning for another reason, because gravity, according to Newton, works based on the mass of the objects involved, and they don't need to be connected in any way. This contradicted the science of the day. The science of the day was based on Aristotelian science, which held that in order for one object to have an influence on another object, they must be connected by a medium that transmits that influence. The same way, if I'm talking to Cy Kellett, if we're in the same room, it's, you know, the reason he can hear my voice, the reason my voice can have an influence on him, is because we have this medium, the air, that is transmitting the sound waves from my voice to his ear, from my mouth to his ear. So according to the science of the day, you needed a connected medium for one object to have an influence on another, but gravity doesn't need that. So you've got action at a distance. And that was like amazing to them. It's like, this can't happen. This contradicts normal science. And he was even accused of introducing into natural philosophy, as it was called then, today we'd call it science, but he was accused of introducing concepts from natural magic, because the idea of gravity involving action at a distance was so unbelievable. And Newton admitted, yeah, I don't have an explanation for why this would work. In fact, even today, we only have kind of sketchy explanations for why gravity works. But it was amazing, and his equations worked. They did describe the way things fall and the way they orbit. And as people got used to the idea, they adjusted to it. It didn't seem so unbelievable to them anymore, but it sure did when Newton first proposed it. So you'll notice what happened in this case. What happened was they got used to the idea of gravity over time, and the reason they entertained gravity over time is because his equations worked. In other words, there was evidence to support the truth of this claim that seemed amazing and bizarre at first. And there have been lots more of those in the history of science. You know, quantum mechanics is incredibly bizarre, but quantum mechanics, so is general relativity, but quantum mechanics and general relativity are the two most successful scientific theories ever. And they're supported by a ton of data. So that leads to the third thing I'd say here, which is there's a lot of data supporting the Christian claim. That's what apologetics does, is it presents data to support a belief in the Christian faith. And so if one is having emotional questions about this sounds so amazing and strange, well, I'd point to those three things. Our emotional reactions are subjective and change over time. And a lot of things are strange in reality, especially when we first hear about them. But if there's good evidence for them, then we should accept them anyway. And there is good evidence for the Christian faith. And I'd recommend, if you want to review that evidence, to, you know, get works that we have at Catholic Answers that provide samples of that evidence.
Andrew?
Yep.
Are you dumbfounded?
Yeah, no, I mean, no, you're good. That all sounds, yeah, that's good. I think I kind of realized in the middle there, a big stumbling block for me is just sometimes I hit this position where I'm just uncomfortable not having answers. Mm-hmm. And because I don't have them, it makes me doubt things, which is not really how faith works. But
yeah, and there are answers for a large number of things. And we've got thousands of online resources available for free whenever you have a question you want to look something up about.
You know what, Andrew? I'd like to send you, if I could, Jimmy's book, Daily Defense.
Yeah.
Because there's 366. They're all one page, right, Jimmy? Kind of one page answers to the 366 maybe most common or most pressing apologetics questions. I think you'll enjoy it, Andrew, and maybe it'll give you a sense of the answers to some of these questions. Hang on, we'll send it to you if you'd like it. We got to take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I'm continually amazed and humbled at the way God can work through me to help so many people. Although I have no idea what the caller's questions will be that day, I trust that the Holy Spirit can use my education and experience to guide, challenge, or comfort those who call.
Mast Appeal with Colleen Kelly Mast, Saturday morning, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. There's a line open. So if you've been wanting to ask Jimmy Akin a question, go ahead and grab that line, 888-3187-884. It's open forum, which is a fun way to end the work week. And Linda's in Oregon, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Linda, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, and Jimmy.
Hi, Linda.
My question is... Can you please explain why the Old Testament is reasonable to believe in? And there are three things in particular that make me question it.
Okay.
The first is how often it says, and so it is to this day, because it doesn't really explain how long it's been since mm-hmm. what it's explaining happened and when they wrote it.
Okay.
The second thing is books that are attributed to Moses and other people that seems like it was written after they died. And so the third is when there was, I can't remember if it was a prophet or a priest that found the books of the law that everyone had forgotten existed. And that seems a little similar to the Book of Mormon to me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay.
Okay. So in terms of the general question of why is it reasonable to believe in the Old Testament? It contains a lot of stuff that's historically accurate. And so we can establish a general reliability for the Old Testament in historical terms. You know, for example, even secular Bible scholars acknowledge, you know, like Jeremiah wrote Jeremiah and he's describing the events that occurred in his lifetime. And actually the histories in the Old Testament, while they're not written according to modern historical conventions, they are quite accurate. And there are books like I believe the exact title is The Historical Reliability of the Old Testament by Kenneth Kitchen. Kenneth Kitchen is an archaeological scholar who has written in defense of the Old Testament as history. But that's on the level of purely reason. There's also another reason why it's reasonable for a Christian to believe in the Old Testament, and that's that Jesus taught us that the Old Testament is the inspired word of God, and therefore we can trust it. Now, we have to understand it correctly, and that doesn't mean that everything in the Old Testament means exactly what we think it means on first glance. We do need to learn about the ancient culture and how it wrote about things and what standards of approximation it used in describing things. But But we have Jesus's word that this is the word of God. And if we trust Jesus, then we can accept the Old Testament. You know, we just need to understand it correctly. In terms of the three follow-up questions you asked, because you really kind of snuck in four questions there, let's take them one at a time. The first one was how to understand passages where it says, and it's been this way down to this day. And there are a few of those. So I'm not, and I may need you to help clarify this for me, I'm not sensing a real reason that such passages would give me to disbelieve in the Old Testament. Clearly what it's doing is it's explaining something that happened in the past and set a precedent that has continued down to the point where the author is writing. And that, you know, presupposes that he is describing something that was the case in his day. He's telling his audience, this is the origin of this thing that we know about in our day. This is where it came from. And it's been that way down to now. But I don't have to know when now is in order to find that credible. I mean, if I'm reading a book, let's say I can date the book's general period to it sometime in the 1800s. Okay. I've got this book. I know it was written sometime in the 1800s, and it's talking about, let's say, an event in the 1500s, like, say, the Protestant Reformation. And it says, the book says Martin Luther broke away from the church and founded the Protestant movement, and it's been that way down to this day. So what I can infer from that is, well, Protestantism was a reality that was around in the world at the time the author was writing, and that was sometime in the 1800s. But I don't have to know whether, well, is this the early 1800s, or is this the late 1800s, or is it the mid-1800s? I don't need to know. Is it 1801 or 1899 or 1837.5? Just knowing this is a historical work, and it's explaining the origin of something that was present in the author's day is sufficient. And so I take the same approach to this kind of passage in the Old Testament. Now, since I study biblical chronology, I often have an idea of when the particular biblical book was written that, you know, says things like this. But I don't need to know specifically when in order to find this credible, any more than I would need to know exactly when in the 1800s something was written that mentions Protestantism's origin and that it was still around in the 1800s. So on this question, Linda, does that help you, or is there something I'm not picking up on here?
Well, I guess when I read that, I always think, well, maybe they're taking something that is going on in their day and like making up a story of how it happened.
Okay. Well, you know, there can be in linguistics, they're called folk etymologies, where you explain the origin of words according to a later idea. But there's a fundamental presupposition, and you know, that happens sometimes where, you know, people have a mistaken idea about where a word came from, and that leads to a folk etymology. Well, there could be the conceptual equivalent of folk etymologies in any number of different kinds of literature. But one of the reasons that humans use language is because it's trustworthy, at least in general terms. You know, historians, when they encounter a historical text and it says, this is where it came from, this is where something came from, they don't automatically dismiss that. You would need some kind of evidence to overturn the presumption of accuracy that we bring to any normal human communication. Like if I said, here in Arkansas, it's getting dark. Well, even if you don't know where Arkansas is, you're probably going to take my word that it's getting dark, because what reason do I have to lie to you? There's a presumption of trust and a presumption of accuracy in all human communications. You need evidence if you want to say, oh, Jimmy Akin is lying, or Jimmy Akin is mistaken. And in the same way, we would need that for the biblical authors. Even from a secular perspective, it's not reasonable to systematically distrust what someone says unless you have evidence that they're wrong. And so consequently, the mere claim from a biblical author that this is where something came from doesn't warrant us to be paranoid and say, oh, well, he must be wrong. We need evidence if we want to claim he's wrong. And so I guess that's what I'd say to that follow-up question. But you had two more follow-up questions that I'm afraid I'm going to have to answer on the other side of the break, because we're coming up on the music. And I'll be happy to address your additional questions once we get past the break.
If you would, just hang on, Linda, and we will we'll do that when we come back. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. You are welcome to call if you have a question. 888-318-7884.
Why We're Catholic is the one book you can hand to anyone to invite them into or back to the Catholic faith. With more than 400,000 copies sold, Trent Horn's book has had a number one ranking on Amazon.com for 5 years running. Now available in softcover, bulk cases, ebook, and on Audible. Find out what the excitement is all about. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic at shop.catholic.com or visit whywearecatholic.com.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answer's own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com, or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
Matt Swaim here. Monday on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll look at this week in Catholic history with Kevin Schmiesing and get you all the latest news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's an open forum. Linda in Oregon has a series of questions, two of which we have dealt with. Jimmy, you wanted to deal with the last two?
Yeah, so I'll need her to refresh my memory on one of them, but I remember one of the others was, references to the books of Moses when they contain material that occurs after Moses' death. So I make a few points here. The first one is that, people do have explanations for how Moses could have written even the parts that involved his death. It would involve prophetic knowledge, which, being a prophet, well, God gave him prophetic knowledge, so he could give him prophetic knowledge of his own death, and he could write that part in principle. But that's a very, very, very minority position. Very few people have thought that, because the passage at the end of Deuteronomy that describes Moses' death just sounds like it's written after his death. And there are a few other things, too, in the first five books of the Bible, the Torah or Pentateuch or five books of Moses, that that also sound like they were written after his death. And you know what? Those books never claim to be written by Moses.
Okay.
They have passages where Moses is quoted, but they never say Moses is the author. And most scholars, and I would agree with this, think that although Moses may have contributed some of the material that was eventually put into those books, that he himself did not write them. And that's a common opinion, but it doesn't challenge anything in the books themselves, because they don't claim to be written by Moses. They occasionally claim to quote from Moses, but they don't say he's the author of the whole book. Now, later, in later centuries, because they do quote Moses a lot, and because he's the principal figure in the five books, he's not really there in Genesis, but you look at the five books as a whole, and he is the principal figure in them, that principal human figure anyway, they came to be associated with Moses. And so it became natural to refer to them as the books of Moses, because he, you know, four of the five, he's there from front to back in those books. And so it became natural to refer to them as the books of Moses. And some people may have inferred from that that he wrote them. And some people might even speak of him writing them as, you know, in a kind of conventional way, without meaning it's a literal historical fact that he wrote every single word himself. And so I would say I don't see a reason to worry here, because the books don't claim to have been written by him. And there are explanations for why in later centuries people would associate them with him and speak about them as if they are of Moses in some sense, which some people might have taken to mean he wrote them. And he may have written passages that are quoted in him, but they never claim he wrote the whole thing. So that's what I'd say about the second question. Linda, what was your third question or fourth question?
Yeah, there was, I don't remember if it was a prophet or a priest that found the books of the law.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So, forgotten existed.
Right, yeah. So this is during the reform of King Josiah, where, you know, there had been a bunch of pagan practices introduced into the temple at Jerusalem, and Josiah is putting an end to that. And as they're getting all the pagan junk out of the temple, they find a book. Now, it's in the singular. It's a book. It is not books, plural. And one of the things about the five books of Moses is they were five books, because there was a limit to how big you could make a book back when books were the same thing as scrolls. No one's going to want to scroll through something that's, you know, 500 pages long. And so there was a kind of a set length for how big scrolls could be. And that's why the books of the Bible are so much shorter than books we have today, because they all need to fit inside of a single scroll, each individual book. So like Genesis was one book, Exodus was one book, Leviticus, Numbers, both of those were one book, and Deuteronomy was one book. So that's why they're five books, because they were five different scrolls. Well, during the reform of King Josiah, they find a book, a single book, that has a description in it of the law. And the common understanding in biblical scholarship is that's a reference not to all five books, because they would have never fit into a single scroll. That's a reference to Deuteronomy. And so if that's the case, well, Deuteronomy basically summarizes what's in the other four books, especially from Exodus to Numbers. And so it doesn't, you know, it sometimes has a little bit of a different regulation, but basically it's a summary of what comes before. And so that doesn't give us reason to doubt that it was, you know, some brand new forgery that was heretical and contradicted previous Israelite writings. It's basically a summary of previous Israelite writings. In fact, that's where the name Deuteronomy in English comes from. In Greek, deuteros means second, and nomos means law, and so Deuteronomy is the second telling of the law. It's just a summary. And so it's consistent with what came before, and consequently, it doesn't really give us a reason to disbelieve that it accurately reflects the thought of the prior portions of the Mosaic literature.
Linda, thank you very much for that.
Let's send Linda a copy of my book, How We Got the Bible.
Okay.
The Bible is a Catholic book.
Yeah. The Bible is a Catholic book. To Linda, just hang on. If you give us an address, we'll send you a copy of Jimmy's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. On we go. Laura is in North Carolina watching on YouTube. Laura, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you again. And Jimmy, this is my most idle question so far, but it's actually one I've wondered about for nearly 5 decades. Okay. So back in the 70s, I went to private secular school with a boy whose family was an institutional benefactor with possible noble roots in Europe. And that boy's given first name was Saint George.
Okay.
Everyone, teachers and staff, as well as students, always called him Saint George, never simply George. And he retained this first name into adulthood, and last time I looked, as a professional man. So here's my question. Is naming children this way any kind of an actual Christian convention or tradition? And does the Catholic Church in particular find anything either problematic or commendable about that?
So historically, Catholics would name their children after saints. The regulations about baby naming are a little bit different now, though. Now, the regulation is that when a child is baptized, it's not to be given a name that is inconsistent with Christian culture or Christian sensibilities. So you wouldn't want to name your baby Satan. But you could name your baby anything as long as it's not in some way offensive to Christian sensibilities. So if you want to name your baby Moon Unit, like Frank Zappa did, well, that's not offensive to Christian sensibilities. I understand Moon Unit these days goes by Moon, which is, is okay as a name. So the church wouldn't have a problem with someone naming their child after a saint and including the saint part. In fact, there has been a historical tradition of this, not just with regard to the name Saint George, but with regard to other names as well. For example, there's a fairly, it's not, I won't say it's common, but it's a name in British history that is around, and some people get named, which is Saint John. Only they don't pronounce it Saint John usually. They slur it, and they pronounce it St. John. So St. John is just the name Saint John that some people have as a given name. There are others too. This happens in Spanish. Psychelet, for example, you may be aware that one of the Spanish equivalents of the name James is Santiago.
Yeah.
Right? Santiago. Right. Well, San in Spanish means saint, and Tiago is a variation on Diego. So Santiago is translating it Saint James. And so there have been lots of people who've had the saint element incorporated into either their given name or their family name. Church has never had a problem with this.
Laura, thank you for the question. I hope that answer was helpful to you. And Jimmy, Darren informs me that he was once on an airplane with Dweezil Zappa.
Yeah, that Moon Unit's brother.
Younger, older? Do we know, Darren? We don't know. Okay. Yeah. But that's exciting news, though.
I also like the name of Penn Jillette's daughter, Moxie Crime Fighter. She goes by Moxie.
Moxie Crime. So is Crime Fighter her middle name, or?
It's all one name as far as I'm aware. Oh, Moxie Crime Fighter. Jillette.
I like the name Moxie. I don't know. There's something cool about that. I'm not that I'm against Crime Fighter, but it's a lot to live up to.
You want your crime fighters to have moxie.
You definitely do. Exactly. All right. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Hi, this is Mike Aquilina with a few words about St. John Chrysostom. St. John Chrysostom is probably the most famous Christian preacher in all of history. His name, which is really a nickname, Chrysostom, means golden mouth. It was given to him because of his preaching. People went to Mass just to hear him preach. St. John Chrysostom was a hero, and he taught us how to speak the truth, but also how to live by that truth, even if we're called to live it heroically.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I feel just so impressed with Darren that he was on a plane with Dweezil Zappa once. There's things I don't know about you, Darren, even after all these years. Important details, like you once flew with Dweezil Zappa. Were you in the same class or was he in a different... He was in a different class. Yes, I thought that might be the case. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Anthony's in Syracuse, New York. Anthony, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. First, thanks for allowing me some time to ask this question. I'm a Catholic confirmed. A lot of my family is the same, but they've went to the Pentecostal church. And I'm curious how to, without offending or stirring up agitation or anger, to explain the biblical basis for purgatory. And in particular, I'm usually met with the response that, and I won't have it exactly right, but when Jesus was being crucified and he turned to one of the others being crucified with him, he mentioned that this day we'll be in paradise together. And from time to time they use that as a basis.
Okay, so let's talk about this. There are two parts to the question. The first part is how to explain purgatory to Protestants without it getting heated. Well, you can't always guarantee that it's not going to get heated, but a way that I found very successful in explaining purgatory to Protestants is to say, look, when we're in heaven, we're going to be perfect. We're not going to have temptations. We're not going to have disordered desires. We're not going to be sinning. And, you know, that's indicated, among other places, in the book of Revelation, where it says nothing unclean shall ever enter the heavenly city. So in heaven, we're going to be perfect. But think about it. Are most of us perfect at the end of this life? And I'll get Protestants agreeing, yeah, most of it. We are going to be perfect in heaven, but most of us are not going to be perfect at the end of this life. So between the end of this life, between death and when we're in heaven, we need to be made perfectly holy. We need to be purified. And that's all purgatory is. It's the final stage of a process that Protestants believe in. They believe that over the course of the Christian life, God makes us progressively more holy, or he progressively sanctifies us, to use the Latin equivalent. Holy is derived from German, sanctus is Latin, so to be made holy and to be sanctified, it's the same thing. So Christ, by his grace, sanctifies us over the course of this life, but that process is usually not complete. At the end of this life, we still need to be made more holy to be ready for heaven. And so God does that for us. And that's what purgatory is. It's the final purification that purifies us of anything that is unholy so that we'll be ready for heaven. Now, how do we explain? And that's, by the way, all that's what the church teaches about purgatory. It doesn't deal with, like, does it take time or does it occur in a particular location? That's all matters of speculation. We know that for some people, you know, when Christ returns, their purgatory is going to be instantaneous. So that's one possible explanation for what Jesus was talking about with the thief on the cross. He said, today you're going to be with me in paradise. Well, maybe for that guy, purgatory didn't take any time. Maybe it was instantaneous. Or as Pope Benedict said in his encyclical on Christian hope, Spes Salvi, you can't really calculate the duration of purgatory in earthly time. It has a kind of existential time or an existential dimension to it, but you can't really calculate it in earthly time units. And so that may be the explanation for Jesus's remark to the good thief that today you'll be with me in paradise. Maybe he was going to have a really short or even instantaneous purification. On the other hand, there are other ways to read that verse. In Greek, there is no punctuation, and so not in the original Greek. And so he also may have meant the following. Now, people tend to read it as, today you're going to be with me in paradise. What he says is, I tell you, today you're going to be with me in paradise. And they attach the today to when he's going to be in paradise. But in Greek, you can also read it the other way. You can attach the today to when Jesus is telling him this. So you can read it, I tell you today, you will be with me in paradise. And if that's what Jesus meant, well, then his purification might have taken a bit longer. But one way or another, it's okay. It's consistent with the doctrine of purgatory either way. And so we don't need to fight about that. And I've found that by presenting purgatory as the final stage of sanctification, it helps a lot of Protestants understand it a lot better and go, oh, yeah, I guess there must be something like that. Because if I'm not perfect at the end of my life, but I'm going to be perfect in heaven, God must purify me.
What do you think, Anthony?
I think it's a thorough explanation, and I appreciate it. And it makes me realize, I think the divide might be more of the sola scriptura framework that they approach the Bible reading with, as opposed to, like you point out, the doctrine of the church and the church fathers' guidance. So is there a way, with that being said, to explain it to Protestants that there needs to be divine cooperation with salvation by faith, because some of the born-again style Protestants think that faith alone means that.
Okay, Anthony, you're putting a bunch of new issues on the table, and we don't have long left in the show. So what I'm going to recommend is that we send you a copy of a couple of 20 Answers booklets that I wrote. One of them is 20 Answers, Faith and Works, since you asked about faith alone. And I believe we also have one. It's either Faith and Work. It's either 20 Answers, Justification, or 20 Answers, Salvation. So I'd suggest we'll send you those and you can get some follow-up. If you want a bigger discussion, you could order a copy of my book, The Drama of Salvation, where I go into all this stuff in a lot more detail.
Anthony, thank you. On we go with just a few minutes left. We'll go to Albany, New York. Elizabeth is in Albany, New York. Elizabeth, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Real quick, Jimmy, I just want to say I called about, I think, a year ago, and at the time I was discerning the Catholic Church, and I'm happy to say that I came into the church or completed my sacrament this past Easter Vigil in 2023, and you were definitely a part of my journey back to the church, so thank you.
Thank you. Welcome home.
Quick question. Yes. So when it comes to the age of the earth, I consider myself to be agnostic at this point. I know that I think you are an old earth creationist. The thing that I'm struggling with is I see the scientific evidence for the Earth being old. However, I do understand the young Earth creationist point that if we hold to a young Earth, an old Earth view, that means we have to accept that there was disease and death before the fall, and that's just something like theologically I don't know how to reconcile that. So what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, well, the first thing I'm going to do, because we're getting down to the end of the show, is recommend three episodes of Mysterious World. They're episodes 119, 120, and 121. So you can get to them by going to mysterious.fm/119 for episode 119. Or mysterious.fm/120 for episode 120, or episode or to mysterious.fm/121 for episode 121. And it's the only three-parter I've ever done in the history of Mysterious World, but I look at the question of the age of the Earth from both the perspective of reason, so I cover the scientific evidence, and from the perspective of faith. So I go into the faith questions like the one you've just asked. But to give you a brief look at that question at the moment, the question is generated by an assumption, which is that there was no death and no disease and nothing like that prior to the fall. And that is an assumption that is not supported by the Bible. It never says there's no death before the fall. What it says is that if Adam and Eve had not eaten from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, then they would have continued living because they would have had access to the tree of life. And so what the Bible indicates is not that death entered the world through the fall, but that human death entered the world through the fall. So other creatures, including human ancestors, could and did die. And this is not a modern opinion that's, you know, like retrofitted because of modern science. This is something that was believed by competent theologians long before modern science even developed in the 1600s. If you go back to the 1200s and ask Thomas Aquinas, did animals die before the fall? He'd say, yeah, they did. Only human death entered the world through the fall. Lions that are obligate carnivores by nature ate meat before the fall, and that meant some gazelles had to die. So the premise that drives the issue that all death entered the world during the fall is simply mistaken. In fact, we actually have evidence in Genesis itself that the world already was subject to entropy prior to the fall, because entropy is the tendency of natural systems to run down and break down over time. And if you don't have entropy, stars won't shine. But we know the stars were shining, so the universe was already subject to entropy. Also, if you don't run down in your energy level, you don't need to eat. And Adam and Eve were given permission to eat. So even the human body was subject to entropy prior to the fall. And as Aquinas points out, any natural system, unless it's supported by grace, will run down and break down over time. So death would have been natural to humans, except they had access to the tree of life, which was a grace that would help keep them alive. Furthermore, we know death specifically existed before the fall, because if you eat a fruit, that fruit dies. And consequently, since Adam and Eve could and did eat fruit, there was plant death. Their digestive systems tore apart the flesh of plants and consumed it, and that flesh of plants died. So we have evidence for a form of death right there in the text of Genesis, and nothing in the text of Genesis says that anything other than humans was free from death prior to the fall. And that's not just my opinion. It's the opinion of other individuals like St. Thomas Aquinas, and I think it solves the problem nicely.
What do you think, Elizabeth?
I have to think about that.
Of course.
It would definitely, everything you just said, it's true. I went over my head. I think I would have to rethink, I suppose, what it means to live in paradise then. Because I think when we think of paradise, especially when it comes to animals, I mean.
Yeah, paradise was for humans. Paradise was not for the animals. A paradise is a kind of a garden. And so the garden was built for God, and he had Adam and Eve as the caretakers of his garden. But he had the whole rest of the world, and that's where other animals and plants were. They didn't all live in the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden's one little local spot. That's why after the fall, God can drive Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden, because there are other places to be. Okay. So the Garden of Eden was one little spot. It did not contain all the plants and animals of the world.
Right. That makes sense. Okay, I'm going to definitely watch the episodes you recommended.
Great. It's episodes 119 to 121.
Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, which you can find at mysterious.fm. What's dropping tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Jimmy?
Well, nothing's dropping tomorrow because today's Friday.
I hate when I do that. What dropped today, Jimmy Akin?
We looked at the chronovisor. Idea is it's like a kind of time television the Vatican allegedly had, and one of the people who claimed the Vatican was involved in this project was one of the most famous exorcists in Italy.
Oh, you got to listen to that. When you get done with those other three, Elizabeth, check out the chronovisor. Elizabeth, thank you for the call. Thanks to everybody who called. But that will about do it for us. Jimmy Akin, thanks for coming in for an extra hour with us today.
My pleasure.
I'm glad you have high tolerance. high
me too.
Cycalic tolerance.
I've developed it over time.
Oh, something you had to work on? Okay.
No, it just helps.
Yeah, right. Well, Edgar, thanks for doing the phones. Darren, famous Darren, I didn't know you were famous. Thanks for doing the production.
He's secretly famous.
Secretly famous. Who's running the video? Oh, Zach, thank you. All right, see you next time, God willing, right here. Gavagance was live.